Today on Next Level E-Commerce.
If we burn the ships, we have to fight our way out. That's the only option. So that's the plan, burn the ships.
Yeah.
It's just like, well, do you have a map? Do you have a sword? I don't know.
You're listening to Next Level E-Commerce. Each week, we feature inspiring stories from entrepreneurs who have taken their business to the next level. They share successes and failures and what kept them going when they felt like giving up. And here's your host, Isaac Smith.
Thank you for joining me for episode 32. This is an episode that you just can't miss. Do you have an operating system? I'm not talking about your computer or even your business. I'm talking about what's going on in your brain. Is it all just random noise, or is there something we can learn from those who perform at a high level? This is my favorite type of interview. We're not talking about how to do SEO or manage your ads or any of that crap. We're learning through someone's story about how a successful entrepreneur makes decisions. Because that's what I always want to know. What's going on in that person's brain? And can I connect in with that? Is there something I can take from that and apply to my life and my business? And in today's episode, you are in for a treat. My guest today is Peter Keller. He's a founder and CEO of Fringe Sport. We'll do a deep dive into what he does, but more importantly, why he does it and how he thinks about it in just a minute. But first, I want to make a quick announcement. In case you missed it, last week my friend Danny Carlson and I hosted the Survive and Thrive E-Commerce Summit. This was a free virtual summit for all e-commerce entrepreneurs, and the focus was not only surviving through this COVID-19 pandemic, but thriving, seeking out the opportunities that are being presented by this unique circumstance. And so how can we not only survive, but thrive during this chaos? So Danny and I reached out to our network. You know, we each have podcasts that give us access to people who are doing really amazing things and some thought leaders in the space. And we found the best and the brightest that we could bring to you guys. And we were hoping for maybe 25 or 30 speakers. It was supposed to be a 3-day event, but we got nearly 50 incredible speakers. These are really successful people who are doing things at a really high level. And instead of being just 3 days, it went on for 4 days. I was completely overwhelmed with the response from the community, from the speakers, from the sponsors. And by the way, the sponsors were not paying us anything. We didn't make any money. They were just helping promote and get more people to the event. And we had over 900 attendees. And the feedback and the impact that it made on the attendees and everybody there was far beyond what I expected. I feel incredibly honored and humbled to be able to support this community in this time of need. So I just wanted to say a few things. Number one, if you came out and joined us and engaged with us at the event, thank you so much. That really meant a lot to me. Number two, if you missed it, it's all still there. All the replays are available and you can go back and watch them. In fact, Peter Keller, my guest today, was one of the speakers and he gave a really great talk that a lot of people told me they really enjoyed. And lastly, and maybe most importantly, we've decided that we are not going to stop. This was supposed to be just a 3-day event, but I tell you, the feedback was so incredible. People were asking for more. And we're just going to continue to serve the community on into the future. So we're still working out exactly what's going to happen there, but it's all going to be in that Facebook group. There were quite a few other speakers who wanted to talk, who we wanted to get on, but it was just too late. The timing was wrong at the moment, so we weren't able to get them in. And so we're going to bring them in and provide all that content for you. It's just going to keep going like this, and we're going to do much deeper dives into subjects. And it's, guys, this is really a community. You know, we've talked about this mission 2x1k and the community and all of this. That's starting right now in this Facebook group where this all happened. So if you want to go back and check out the previous talks, I invite you to do that. If you want to engage with our new content that's coming out, interviews with other people, deep dives into how to do things, Facebook Lives, all this stuff, it's going to be there in that same Facebook group. So to get there, all you have to do is go to surviveandthrivesummit.co. There's going to be a link there that just takes you right to the Facebook group, and that's where everything is. So come in, watch all that great content, engage with us, engage with the rest of the community. I'd be so happy and honored to have you there. Again, that's surviveandthrivesummit.co, and just click the link there. It'll take you right to the Facebook group. If you're driving, I'll make sure to have the link in the show notes that'll take you where you need to go. All right, now we're going to move on with the show. Links to everything we discuss will be in the show notes at nextlevelecommerce.co/32. My guest today, Peter Keller, as I mentioned, is CEO of Fringe Sport. And they do home gyms? Or what was that? Garage gym equipment? Wait, I think it's something about CrossFit, right? Oh, forget it. Let me just have Peter tell you what's going on over there at Fringe Sport.
My name is Peter, and I believe in strength. I'm the CEO of a company called Fringe Sport, and we exist to help people improve lives through strength. The principal ways that we do that are by helping people build amazing garage gyms and helping entrepreneurs build thriving community gyms. Now, to get down to the nitty-gritty, the principal way we do that is by designing, manufacturing, and distributing strength and conditioning equipment. Think barbells, kettlebells, squat racks that are both super high quality, number two, at a great price, and number three, backed by world-class customer service. And while we do principally go to market through e-commerce, I do think of us as a direct-to-consumer brand. So there's my spiel.
That's awesome. Yeah, sounds like you've done that a few times. You got
once
it all.
Or twice.
Yeah. That's cool. So how did you get into this? Is this you told me you went to University of Texas in Austin. So is that what you wanted to do after college, or is this something that sort of evolved on its own?
Sort of. Let's start a little further back. I've always liked selling things. From being in middle school or elementary school, I was buying things out of the back of Boys Life magazine and selling them to my friends at a markup. Probably not enough of a markup at that time, but I learned a little more as time went on. Then in high school, I was selling candy. Honestly, if I was smart, I would have been selling drugs, better margins, more volume. But never got into that. And then in college, the first dot-com bubble was going. And again, I loved the idea of retail. I loved selling things. And so at the tail end of the dot-com bubble, I managed to get a job with an e-commerce company here in Austin, Texas. As you mentioned, I went to the University of Texas. I actually got a film degree from the University of Texas. Hindsight being 2020, maybe I should have gone for an engineering degree, but film, that's where I am. So I got a job with an e-commerce company here in Austin, Texas. They're called Living Direct. They're still around today. If you want to buy an ice maker, an air conditioner, or a small refrigerator, livingdirect.com, baby.
Nice.
And it might even be an ice maker, air conditioner that I designed. because they still have a few of those.
Oh, really?
From my days. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
So I worked, yeah. So I worked for them for 10 years and was working my way up. And to be honest, I was a terrible employee. I did make the company a lot of money, but I only did what I thought was cool. And I only worked on stuff that interested me. And I never really understood until I started my own business, like what a a-hole I was. Like, how hard could it have been to manage me? But after about 7, 8, 9 years in at that company, things were going well for me. One of my friends had been saying, hey, Pete, you got to read the 4-Hour Work Week. You got to read the 4-Hour Work Week. You got to read the 4-Hour Work Week. And I read the 4-Hour Work Week. And it was kind of a watershed moment. There's a bunch of stuff in that book that I'd been thinking about on my own. And then it just all came together with that book. Simultaneous to me reading that book, the CFO of the company that I worked for took me out to lunch. And he said, Peter, I'm really worried about you. And I said, well, you know, things are going great here. Like, what are you worried about? And he said, I'm worried you are right at the cusp of making too much money. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I've seen it happen before. This is a CFO, a few decades older than me, really nice guy, you know, knew what he was doing. He said, I've seen it happen before. There are people who have this entrepreneurial spark and spirit, but they're in corporate America and they start making too much money in corporate America. And then they buy a house that they maybe can't afford or maybe is right at the edge of what they can afford. They buy a BMW, they get married, they have some kids, and all of a sudden that money, they were marching up in salary, the salary becomes like heroin, it becomes like a drug. And then they can't start their own business because if you deprive them of that salary for the amount of time that it potentially takes to start their own business, they just go, they're going cold turkey and they can't do it. Their system can't handle it. Their wife wants a vacation to Hawaii. They want to drive the BMW. They want to live in this really nice house. And he said, I see that you're right at the edge of that. So if you start making a little bit more money, you've talked to me before about potentially wanting to start your own business. If you make a little more money, I'm going to tell you, you will never do it because you're going to get hooked on the salary. So I said, wow, I don't even know what to say. You know, it's not every day that he wasn't my boss, but you know, it's not every day that like a mentor says, hey, quit your job. Like you shouldn't be here. So I had the 4-Hour Work Week on one hand. I had this gentleman giving me a wake up call on the other. And then my wife was pregnant with our first kid and I was about to turn 30. And so I started to see the wisdom of these words that if I didn't do it now, I was probably never going to do it. And I'm not really a regrets guy, but I probably would have looked back at like what might have been. So I took a look at what I was really interested in. I really wanted to work in some area that I was passionate about. And I ran down a little bit of a niche selection exercise that I made up myself. And I got down to watches and CrossFit. And so I decided I'm either going to start a watch company or I'm going to start a strength and conditioning equipment company because I love watches and I love CrossFit. The deciding factor for me, honestly, was that I figured that I would need 50K to make an MVP, a minimum viable product for the watch company. And I figured I would need 2 to 5K to start a strength and conditioning equipment company. So that's what I did.
Yeah. Wow.
I had some connections in China and I looked for a, again, MVP, minimum viable product. So if your listeners aren't familiar, there's a startup methodology called Lean Startup. And what Lean suggests you do is you create the most stripped down version of a product that you possibly can that you believe fulfills the minimum attributes that your customers would expect or be willing to pay you for a product. And then you get your customers to pay you for that product. You actually have a business. So I found some gymnastics rings. So these are rings that you hang from a pull-up bar or tree branch, something like that. And then you can do pull-ups. You can do some light gymnastics exercises on them. They were used a lot in CrossFit back then, and of course, even still to this day. And I figured if I can sell these, then I can have a business. So I started selling those, sourced them from China, put them in my garage, started shipping them out, sold them on a Shopify website, sold them on eBay, was driving traffic by doing some blog posts, working some forums, doing some Google ads. Back then it was called AdWords. And right. We started selling some. So things started to get a little traction. And I started to say, okay, I can sell one product, but can I sell another product to the same people that I sold the first product to? So I sourced some kettlebells. Sure enough, I could sell those. And from there, it's off to the races.
Wow. Man, that story of the CFO taking you out, that's really incredible. Like, what a favor he did. And it's so true. You see it all the time. People get locked in, and it's not always just with, making a lot of money, but, like just from my life, I've felt trapped by being in the professional world. For me, it was like exactly that. Your expenses are being covered, but not much more. With the dual income, and then we had a kid. Of course, the clincher, tons of student loan debt. So yeah, that's exactly right. Like, it was really hard for me to break out of that. And of course, you see lots of other people going down that path and people being unhappy and then feeling like they can't leave. So how did you see the truth in that? Did you see the, like, that's actually would happen to you? What did you think when he's telling you this?
That's a great question. When he was telling me this, I thought, this guy's crazy. I don't understand. Everybody else at this company is trying to lock me in and keep me here. And he's telling me that for those very reasons, I need to leave. Mm. And so he just confused me. I felt comfortable with him. I had shared with him my entrepreneurial dreams, but I thought it was crazy that, and I believe he literally said the phrase, "Peter, you're going to forget how to eat ramen." And I just didn't know what to take and what to make of it at that time. Now, in hindsight, it was amazing advice for quite a few reasons. One of the things was I was working my way up the corporate ladder. I was making more money, but I was also not happy. And it's really interesting. Hindsight's 2020, right? If I had been able to deal with my unhappiness for an additional 2 years, so the company sold about 2 years after I left, and the sale of that company probably would have netted me, or let's say grossed me, about $1 million. So if I had been able to deal with my unhappiness for an additional, I didn't know this at the time.
Yeah,
when I left. But if I had been able to deal with my unhappiness for an additional 2 years, I probably would have benefited to the tune of $1 million by staying there. However, again, hindsight being 2020, I think that I would have gotten divorced from my wife had I stayed at that job. I think that I would have been a far less happy human being. And I think I would have been a far less useful to society human being. So I know in my heart and in my bones that that gentleman did me one of the biggest favors of my life by telling me the facts of life as he saw them at that moment. Wow. I do want to mention one other thing about that, though, that's tangentially related. I founded my business on the side while I was still working for my employer. And I did it for a year. And at the end of the year, I came to a crossroads. I was trying to create Tim Ferriss talks in the 4-Hour Workweek about a muse. Mm-hmm. And a muse is basically a passive income business that you have to do fairly little about or fairly little activity to, and then just generates money for your dream lines that you mm-hmm. can live your life. I was trying to, at that time, build a muse. Passive income, baby.
Right.
At the end of that first year, I realized fringe sport would never be a muse. It would never be, for me, a passive income business. But it could be a amazing business that could have a massive impact on a ton of people and help make their lives better, and could be very financially rewarding for me, and could be a lot of fun, and probably a great use of my skills. So at that point, I talked with my wife. My wife's name's Valerie. She, of course, knew I had this business on the side, but she did think I was trying to do more or less a passive income type of business. Hey, we invested some money. Soon we'll get some dividend from that money, and then the dividends will just keep on coming. And I told her that that's not what was going to happen with this business, and that I wanted to quit my six-figure corporate job that I was unhappy at. But they're all good people there over at Living Directed. You know, unhappiness comes from within. But I was unhappy, and I wanted to quit the job, and I wanted to focus full-time on fringe sport. And I told her this would mean that I would make nothing, no money for some period of time, and then I would start building back up until I make what my old salary was. And then, God willing, I would eventually make a lot more money than that. So she bought into that and she said, baby, I believe in you. Now, she had never thought that she was signing up to become the sole provider for our family. Just in her mindset, it was like, Peter's going to provide for our family. But when I quit from my job for 10 months, I didn't take a single dime out of fringe sport. And after 10 months, I started paying myself $10 an hour. And then I paid myself $10 an hour for probably another year. And I salaried myself at 40 hours a week. So it's making $400 a week. Going from six figures, well into the six figures, to $400 a week kind of sucked. And it took a long time, years, to make it back to where I was making what I had left. And my wife, I wasn't clear enough about what that path would look like and about what those time frames could be. You know, I told her, hey, optimistically, like, you know, we'll do this for a year and then I'll be making $1 million a year or something like that. But it didn't work out that way.
Sounds so familiar, by the way, but I don't want to interrupt. Go ahead.
No worries. So I guess what I'm trying to say is one of the big unintended consequences that came from that is I did quit my job and my wife supported me, but she didn't realize what she was supporting when she was supporting me, when she made the commitment to support me. And so that's also something that I learned is in setting expectations with those around you, loved ones, and also understanding, hey, I'm going to paint this glorious rosy picture, but for the people who are really important that the downside of that picture can have a massive effect on, you might want to tell them. There's a little chance that it's going to take longer than we thought. So, you know, that was something there.
Yeah, that's almost exactly what I did. my wife and I worked in Washington, D.C. I'm from Portland, and I decided I can't take this anymore. I want to focus on business. We've got to move in with my parents all the way across the country. And so I talked her into it. Somehow she went along with it, but it was that thing. You know, you're starting a business. You don't know how long it's going to take or even if it's going to work out at all. But I think we as entrepreneurs are such optimists. We just see what everything could be. And so we did that. We moved in with my parents. That was 5 years ago now almost. And, you know, it took way longer than than we all thought it would. So that puts a strain on your relationship and your, you know, we're still not where I thought I was going to be, even though we're much better off than we were when we started. But so that I know, but I don't know how to really, address that. Like, I don't know how else to do it, you know, like, I'm not sure she would have bought in, you know, if I had known what I know now. But yeah, it's weird, you know?
Sometimes when you swim across a river that's infested with crocodiles, it's best to just not know the crocodiles are there. And then look, and then yeah. You get to the other side, you look back, holy crap, there were a bunch of crocodiles in that river. I didn't know, but I made it.
Yeah.
I will say something else is that my wife and I are very different people. So I'd mentioned before that my undergrad is a film degree. I did go back for a graduate degree and ended up getting my MBA. She also, her undergrad is a double major in psychology and French, and then she went back and got her master's in counseling. So one of the things that I'm mentioning this for is she tends to be a little more feeling, and I tend to be a little more data oriented. And so when this comes down to it, when I have goals, let's say financial goals, they're typically are numbers attached to them. When she doesn't have any financial goals, but she just wants to be comfortable. And one of the things that I've told her is I've said, okay, well, you're not tying numbers to comfortable. What you call comfortable, I think a lot of people would call really rich. And she's like, oh no, yeah, rich people are jerks. Rich people are a-holes. I don't want to be like that. I just want to be comfortable. Oh, what does comfortable mean, baby? Oh, I never have to worry about money and I can do everything I want. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. That's totally middle class. So, but I want to mention here, I love my wife so much. And I'm not trying to imply that I'm right and she's wrong. I'm just saying there are different ways of looking at the world. But yeah, I've got some numbers attached to what my goals are.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of similarly, when we started deciding that this is what we were going to do, we were going to sell our condo, we're all both going to quit our jobs, we're going to move. I kept talking about this. I'm much like a pie in the sky, like just the vision kind of thinker. And she says, but okay, great. Let's do it. We need a plan. And I'd say, what are you talking about? That's the plan. Sell the condo, move across the country. What more do you need? But
if we burn the ships, we have to fight our way out. That's the only option. So that's the plan. Burn the ships.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, do you have a map? Do you have a sword? Do you have food? I don't know. But yeah, takes both kinds of, you know?
Yeah. Very different kinds of people in this world.
Yeah. Well, to refocus, I'm back on e-commerce. I have a number of things that I've been pretty pivotal and interesting recently.
Okay.
I had listened to a few of your previous podcasts and I thought about a couple of things. One we talked about in the pre-interview is you had Kiri Masters on recently and she talked about personality profiling. I was really interested in that. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's dive in.
Awesome. Well, I've been using personality profiling on employees at Fringe since the very start. I was using StrengthsFinder. And to be honest, the reason I was using that was because A, someone had introduced me to it, and B, it was cheap. That said, I was not finding exactly what I needed with StrengthsFinder. It did help me, I think, in managing some employees, but I think that was about it. So a few years ago, I got introduced to a personality profiling system called Culture Index. And I love it. Love it, love it, love it. I've taken the profile. My wife's taken the profile. My business partner's taken the profile. any employee that we hire gets profiled before we hire them. And I've even experimented with having some employees, like when we have an open position, have the employees not submit a resume, just take the profile. And then if it match, we think we're looking for, then we ask for a resume. I will say that I backed off that a little bit, but it's amazing. So let me explain to you how Culture Next works.
Please.
You are assigned or select a Culture Index trainer. So you have a human who is trained in Culture Index who becomes essentially your Culture Index coach. He or she then puts you through a two-day boot camp so that you can understand Culture Index. And then from there, you have a yearly license to run as many people through the profile tool as you want. So there's a cost for the yearly license that has unlimited people you can run through. And then there's a cost for that first training for you and any of the other employees that you send through. But then from there, you not only get unlimited profiles, you also get unlimited access to your coach. So when I first started using Culture Index, I had myself profiled. I had all my team profiled. And then with our coach, I went through the entire team, including myself, and he laid up, okay, what are the job responsibilities? What, you know, do you generally speaking want this person to be thinking and doing? You want them to be much more data? Do you want them to be much more people focused? Do they need to be a leader that's thinking up these visions and crazy ideas? Do they need to be a follower who's cleaning up behind the leader and making sure that everything gets buttoned up? So he goes through your entire team that way. And then he gives you suggestions on what to do with your team. Suggestions might be move this person here, move that person there. Might be you probably need somebody else with this profile in this role. And then you get to call him and you can talk about, hey, I'm having a problem with this person or that person. He looks at their profile with his expert eye and then helps you to manage through that. And then when you're hiring new people, he works with you on what profile you are probably looking for that new person. And then when you have those applicants fill out the profiles, without knowing anything about the applicant's resumes, he just takes a look at their profiles versus what you thought was the ideal profile and helps you to hire that way. Now, all this sounds very dehumanizing. But what it has helped us do is it's helped us to put people in positions that they are naturally suited for and are more likely to be happy in and excel in them.
Yeah.
So it's been major, major, major for us. Whenever anybody talks to me about personality profiling, I always give them a little sales pitch on Culture Index and then put them in touch with my trainer because it's been huge for Fringe Sport.
Wow. So that's interesting. So that is a lot more. It's a lot more involved, and you have because, you know, like when you take let's say like a Myers-Briggs personality test, people do this all the time. There's free tests, but you know, from what I gather from people who know this field, that's not. While it's interesting, it's not super useful unless you have somebody who's trained to help interpret what this means and apply it to you to give you insight. It sounds kind of similar. So you have there's this test involved, but what's a really critical component is the person who is able to. See how this fits in your business with the people that you have in there.
Absolutely. And that's been so critical for me. I have a lot of resources around me. I have an executive coach. I have a therapist for me personally. I'm in EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, and I have a lot of resources to me through there. I have masterminds. But my Culture Index coach is really one of the most critical people on, let's say, the support system for Peter Keller, CEO. Because not only does he help me with these other people, but I often call him and say, hey, I'm struggling with this particular issue. Can you help me understand that? And many times he'll just pull up my chart and he'll say, well, Pete, the reason you're struggling is you know, you're asking for data from this person because your chart says that you need data in order to make decisions. And this person is more of a people person, less of a data person. So they're trying to give you the people side where you just really need the data side. And then it's up to me. Do I modify myself to meet that person? Or do I say, hey, totally cool that you are the way that you are. I need data to make this decision, and I need you to understand that that's what I need. I want to support you, but I need the data, and then we can move forward on that. So,
yeah. And to go back to what you were saying about maybe it sounds dehumanizing, but really it doesn't to me. It sounds like, do you know, I just blanked on his name. I think Dan Sullivan. From Strategic Coach, you heard of him?
Yes, I have heard of Dan Sullivan.
He has this concept called unique ability. And okay, yeah, everybody has.
Sorry, I'm shaking my head. Yes, that's yeah. Great. Pod shaking the head.
Yeah. So the unique ability is what it sounds like. Everybody has, like what you're describing, innate, you know, perspectives and interests and abilities and just what makes you thrive. And so our job as business owners and CEOs and, you know, the entrepreneur is to get the people in the right seat the right person for the right seat. You know, this comes out of the book Traction. But Dan Sullivan talks about it a lot, but yeah, exactly that. So, it may sound like it's dehumanizing, but actually in reality, it sounds like it's more, humanity affirming, you know, putting people in an environment that they are able to thrive. So that's really cool.
So I agree with that, Reed. The dehumanizing part that I was referring to is there's a thread of belief, at least an American belief, every little kid can be president. And while I agree with the spirit of that statement, not every person is ideally suited for every job.
Right.
There's a reason that airline pilots fly the plane and artists make art. Because, and I'm sure there are artists who also fly planes, but generally speaking, the structured sort of person that is probably a very good pilot may not be the stereotypically freewheeling type of person who's going to be an amazing artist. And so I view our job as leaders and CEOs to help identify the people who would be good at, thrive, and be happy at being the airline pilot and put them into that role. And then same thing with the artist. But I have run into issues with people before that were poor fits for the role, but really wanted it.
Right.
And that's when you run into the kind of the dehumanizing aspect of some of these personality profiling systems. Because it's also, like, I can see it from that way too. Culture Index takes 5 to 10 minutes.
Really?
So, yes. So are you gonna tell me that by me clicking a few buttons on a browser for 5 to 10 minutes, that system sees into my soul?
Huh.
It's an open question.
Good. Yeah, that's a...
But one thing I did take out of... I remember I took an operations management class for my MBA. And the biggest thing... took a few things out of that class. But the biggest thing I took out of that class is if a tool helps you to make better decisions, sometimes you don't need to think so much about that tool. It's also what I refer to now, and I actually stole this idea from CrossFit, of the black box. So if you have a process or system or something, let's metaphorically obscure the process or system with a black box. Let's just look at the inputs that go into the box and then the outputs that come out of the box. If you put one thing in and then another thing comes out in a predictable manner, sometimes you don't need to worry so much about what's in the box. And so that's kind of how I treat Culture Index. I put in employee attributes and outputs come out that I have seen over time to help me make better decisions. So if somebody, because a few times a few employees have made some of those arguments that I mentioned about Culture Index, and I've said, I give you points on your argument. But in the black box system, inputs go in, better decision making comes out. So let's not worry about it so much.
That, yeah, that is a very, very interesting idea. Actually, I've just been reading and thinking a lot about the book Antifragile by Nassim Taleb. Have you read this?
Or heard? It's one of those books that I've not read that so many people have talked to me about that, A, I should read it.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with what I believe to be the main thrust, which is that the opposite of fragile is not robust, but is in fact anti-fragile, and that we should strive to build anti-fragile organizations so that shocks to the organization make the organization stronger rather than damaging it or destroying it.
Yeah, it's a tough concept to wrap your head around. I struggle with understanding it, but there is a concept in that book that I find very interesting and actually opened my mind. It's similar to what you're talking about, the black box. He talks about how we are often so, I don't know, persuaded or focused on why things work or don't work or how, we lose track of simply whether or not they do work. And so his example, and I am not at all, this you would understand more than me, but his example is somebody is going on a low carb diet, and the reason they finally were convinced to do it was because they read some study of like how it works at a molecular level or whatever. Or why it works, not whether or not it works. And his discussion is, well, that's just stupid because we're going to find out in 15 years that that's actually not really right anyway. It's just our current understanding. But we know if you do this, you get that. So why can't that be enough? So I think that's pretty interesting combined, you know, thinking about the cultural index or the culture index.
So I think I definitely need to read Anti-Fragile, especially since you mentioned that. So I want to tell you what I think one of my superpowers is. One of my superpowers is I can believe anything that I want to believe for a set period of time. And then I can say, did believing this for this period of time help, hurt, or neutral? And then make a decision based on that. So I want to give you a sometimes controversial example of this.
Bring it.
When I was 12, I was a precocious reader as a boy. Even at 12, I was reading like Kurt Vonnegut, stuff like that. And when I was 12, I started thinking about it. And I thought, there is no God. It makes zero sense for some dude to be sitting on a throne up there in heaven and like meddling or thinking or being like, gay person, I hate you. or you're good. Okay, you get into heaven, or something like that. I was like, this makes no sense whatsoever. So from the age of 12 on, I was an atheist. And maybe when I was like 17 or 18, I was an annoying atheist that would occasionally argue or pick a fight. But from like 18, 19, I was just a quiet atheist. I would not talk to people about it. But I had my own belief, which is to say, not. So I was a quiet atheist from 12 to my 20s into my 30s. And in my 30s, I started to realize I wasn't as smart, just globally, not just about faith. I wasn't as smart as I thought I was when I was younger, or possibly not even as smart as I think I am now. And during that, I have a friend who's a very staunch Catholic, to the point where some of his beliefs at times I would have found repugnant in terms of beliefs about other people's choices in life. But I had a conversation with him about his faith, which he shared with me, that really helped me to understand that his faith was much more nuanced than I had anticipated it to be. And so that started me thinking about my lack of faith. Because from 12 on, I had just taken it as an element of faith. There is no God. And I would, forgive me, go a little further and say, if you believe in God, you're stupid. That is an internal belief that I had. But after this, my friend sharing his faith journey with me, I thought, wow, this is more complicated than I thought it was. And then I started thinking about faith. And as I define it in my brain, faith is belief in the absence of proof, or possibly logic, or possibly reason. And if I'm correct about that definition of faith that I hold in my head, I've actually not looked it up in a dictionary, but if I'm correct about that definition of logic that I have in my head, proof means no faith, because you don't need faith if something is proven. So then I started to think, maybe I'm wrong about me thinking there's no God, or maybe I'm right, but maybe there's value in faith and in the belief. And so I told myself, I'm going to believe, and I was raised to believe in a Christian God, so I chose to believe in a Christian God. Although I could have easily chosen to believe in any other spiritual entity. But I decided for 3 months, I'm going to believe in a Christian God and Jesus Christ as his son and the savior. And at the end of that 3 months, I looked back and I said, was my life better or worse or the same from me believing this? Do you want to guess?
Oh man, this is, I'm going to guess it was better.
My life was better.
Yeah.
For having faith and believing. And so I decided, okay, I did it for 3 months. Now I'm going to do it for some arbitrary period. I'm just going to believe and I'm going to study the Bible. And so I started doing that. And periodically I would look back and I would say, is my life better or worse or neutral? And I'll tell you, I started going to church again. And my life was neutral or worse from going to church. But from studying the Bible, reading devotionals, and thinking about the Psalms and thinking about the teachings of Jesus, my life was better. And so I decided, Peter, you're no longer an atheist. You're now a Christian. Wow. So I want to be clear. I'm not telling you this story to proselytize. I'm not trying to inquire as to your personal faith or to have any listeners say, hey, you have to follow Jesus. All I'm trying to say is that I decided to test if having faith would make my life better, worse, or neutral, and it made it better. And so I decided to have faith.
That's amazing. Well, because we're on the subject, I am a Christian as well.
Good. I'll see you in heaven.
Yeah. Not you other suckers.
That's a joke.
I know I'm joking too. Just so everybody knows. Yeah, that's really cool. So I don't have anything remotely similar to that experience, but it's really, I think, incredible that I'm seeing this, you're talking about nuance. I'm seeing this nuance in you. You're describing yourself as this logical person contrasted with your wife, who is very different. And so you applied your logic to something like faith, which I have the same sort of definition as you do. If you had proof of something, you don't need faith. So there's no faith in proof. So you applied logic to something that is inherently without logic, and so I find that pretty interesting, actually, that you could mix those two things.
I think you can. And to bring back to something that I'd mentioned earlier in the interview, I'd mentioned being unhappy when I was working in my corporate job. And I mentioned happiness comes from within. When I was at that corporate job and when I was younger, I did think, oh, if only I have this, or if only I do that, or if only I get to there, then I'm going to be happier or happy or whatever you put there. And the truth is, that's a lie. That's a fool's pursuit or a fool's bargain. Happiness comes from within. I could be happy at that moment, or I could be unhappy at that moment. Have you read Man's Search for Reason by Viktor Frankl?
That is such a familiar sounding title, but I've never read that.
So, long story short, Viktor Frankl was a Jewish person who was in the concentration camps, and he couldn't understand why some people were like happy in the concentration camps and why some people survived and were unhappy even having survived. This is probably a bastardization of maybe his lessons of the book. But what I took from it, which I do think was the main lesson of the book, is happiness comes from within. All this stuff that's flying around at you, happening to you or around you, or to steal from Tony Robbins, happening for you, you can interpret as you so desire. And you can decide to be happy, you can decide to be miserable, you can decide to be however you want to be. But you can decide. And when you talked about me trying to apply logic to these things that defy logic, or to borrow a word that I like to think about when I think of God with a capital G, things that are ineffable, I can decide how I want to deal with those things. And I can apply logic to emotion or logic to faith or something like that. And again, black box, if it makes things better, then I will continue to do so. If it makes things neutral, maybe, maybe not. Makes things worse, throw it away. So one of the things that I have also noticed about myself is that whenever I talk about business, quote unquote, I tend to bring a lot of other stuff in. I'm not a three steps to optimize your site guy.
Well, this is not the show for that anyway.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. Good. But I am I've always been a voracious reader, like I mentioned, and I've always been extremely curious. I think very intellectually curious just about many things. And one of those things is I love people who care about something, even if it's something, I find them fascinating, even if it's something that I potentially disagree with. So I don't think we should talk politics here, but I find so much about President Trump and many things around President Trump fascinating, endlessly fascinating. So it started for me. I love public speaking. I'm the president of a Toastmasters chapter here in Austin. By the way, if any of your listeners haven't looked into Toastmasters, it is the cheapest and some of the best personal development you can possibly do.
All right, that's it. I'm in. I've been hearing about this and people saying, you need to do this. You need to do that. All right, that settles it. I'm in.
Toastmasters is amazing. But so back to President Trump, when he was running for office, I didn't think he had a chance in hell. But when I saw footage of his rallies, I thought, holy moly, this guy, this jerk, sorry, he touches people in their hearts and he gets their emotions. Just like he hits them right in their emotional core. He's got some real skill there. You know, whatever else you say about him. And then as I also, you know, a few other things that I thought were fascinating is I talked with some of my relatives who were, you know, diehard Trump fans. And I was trying to figure out, you know, why? Why are you guys diehard Trump fans? And even after he was in office, because I don't know if she says or not, but the tax cuts that he pushed through were pretty favorable for me. But for a lot of people who were diehard Trump fans, I think the tax cuts are either neutral or I don't think they're worse necessarily, but neutral or like a little bit of benefit. And so I just feel like they supported someone who doesn't, like, with actions actually really help them. And so I was trying to figure out, like, why do you still care about him so much? And again, I think it's because, put the actions aside, he's so good at going for that emotional core.
Yeah.
And further, I live in Austin, Texas. We talked about that at the top of the show. And I had mentioned, I had mentioned to you that I've lived here for about 20 years. In the 20 years that I've lived in Austin, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but our population has swelled like crazy. So many people are moving here. So many condos and skyrises are going up. The town is changing so much, and so much is happening here. It's a great town for entrepreneurship, great town for tech, a great town for, now, for my concern, raising a family. So the rising tide in Austin is truly raising all boats. Even as people might complain about the housing costs going up or traffic getting worse, the reality is when I graduated from the University of Texas in 1997, the starting salary that I got was $28,000 a year for my job. I graduated in 2001. The starting salary that I got was $28,000 a year. I did think it was low, but if you looked at my friends, a lot of my friends are making like $35,000 a year, something like that. And now kids getting out of the University of Texas are making, with undergrad degrees, 60, 70, 80, a few years out, they're at 100 here in Austin, if they're, you know, diligent about really working that up. And so Austin is a place where the last 20, 30 years, there's just been this rising tide. And part of that rising tide has been, I don't know, liberalism or like neoliberalism or whatever you want to call it. But then when you look at other parts of the country, so basically the thing is, as I sit here in Austin and look at my employees, look at myself in the mirror, we all believe, oh, things are getting better. Everything's getting better, better, better. But if you go, I've been to some of these rural parts of the country. I have some family in northern Michigan, for example. There's not a rising tide there, especially in these old excuse me, Rust Belt or mm-hmm. old hubs of manufacturing, their best days, at least as they think, appear to be behind them. Whereas in Austin, there's a belief that our best days are in front of us. And if you believe that your best days are in front of you, you're probably not going to vote for a guy who's like, best days were behind us, but I can put them in front of us, because you already, you have a disconnect there. Mm. But if you're in Northern Michigan and things are kind of crappy, this message has resonance.
Yeah.
Anyways, we don't have to talk about Trump anymore, but just something that I find fascinating.
It is fascinating. And I think actually, yeah, we don't have to talk politics. And actually, I am allergic to politics because I don't agree with anybody. I think all of you guys are wrong.
Yeah, but I'm much more on that.
Yeah,
wavelength.
And so, like, when I hear this, it does make me a little bit more aware that you guys are missing the show. Exactly like what you're talking about. And there's a fascinating book, and I know he's extremely polarizing, but Scott Adams, the Dilbert guy, has become this. Yes, Win Bigley. He's become this big Trump guy. But if you can ignore all of that and read that book, Win Bigley, he talks about how Trump is using these persuasion techniques and you know, you don't have to believe everything in that book, but it's fascinating.
I thought Win Bigley was amazing.
Yeah.
So everybody, when you talk about persuasion, everybody talks about Cialdini and his book, Persuasion. To be honest, I read a lot, but I've picked up that book 5 times and I've never really been able to crack into it. But then I picked up Win Bigley and boom, I just devoured it. So that's one of the things I tell people is if you want to learn about persuasion and you can handle reading a whole book about how great Donald Trump is, pick up Win Bigley, because it really helps you to understand persuasion and how it's wielded by someone who's really good at it.
Yeah.
That said, I do think Scott Adams gives a little too much credence to the planning of some of this stuff. I think some of this stuff is just gut or luck for Trump, and then Scott Adams is ascribing motivation to. But back to what I said about black box, whether it's, you know, planning or genius or gut or luck, I mean, if you put one thing in one end, something else comes out the other end.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about it so much.
Yeah. If you can learn to recognize that, that's awesome. Hey, I did want to follow up. I remember when I got lost there for a second, I remember what I was going to say. This is something that I've been hearing a lot. When you started talking about happiness and the happiness coming from within, on podcasts about entrepreneurship, of course, it's entrepreneurship is really, you said Toastmasters is the best self-development course. I think entrepreneurship in general could be put there as it is self-development. And when I hear people talking about this, we're talking about faith. It is interesting to me. It's actually surprising to me that people, when they say they discovered that things aren't going to make them happy, happiness comes from within. And I feel listening to a lot of these self-development, that's not a negative, self-development oriented conversations, whether it's in entrepreneurship or not, it's interesting for me, having been raised and still a person of faith, that especially specifically Christian background, a lot of these things are not new to me. Like, I feel like I have such a huge advantage in that regard, because everybody always told me that things were not going to make me happy. Achievements are not going to make me happy. Happiness, like you say, comes from within or from above. You know, maybe those two are the same. But I did want to circle back to that, because I think that is very interesting to me, that the secular world seems to be figuring this out. I don't know, for the first time, but at least they're talking about it now, which is interesting to me.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting. I do think I'm not picking up necessarily the same wavelengths of this being a necessarily a broad-based cultural conversation or something that's simmering there, but maybe my antenna are just not out for it. That said, when I was growing up, there was not a ton of emphasis to me put on happiness or my own happiness. And in fact, I remember thinking in my late 20s and into my early 30s, when I started thinking about my own happiness, that that was kind of a like weak thing to think about or very privileged. I don't know. Yeah. Like something that I shouldn't be worried about. Like I should be worried about working hard and making money and, you know, having a family and having the family name, you know, carry on through the generations. Like to worry about happiness was, yeah, it was not part of me. It was not proper for a man, I guess, to really, I don't know if it would be proper for a female as I say that, but it's just not a proper thing to worry about.
Interesting.
But now, as I've gotten a little bit older, I do think it is a major thing, especially because I have two kids. And one of my biggest goals in life is to raise them to be happy, healthy adults, and for me to have a fulfilling relationship with them as adults where I see them often. So that's a major goal of mine in life. And if I'm not happy, I find it difficult to believe that I would be able to raise them to be happy and fulfilled human beings. And I do believe it's a blessing to be alive. I do believe the world is a wonderful place, but I also believe, again, that happiness comes from within. So my daughters could be miserable or could be super happy. And part of my job as a parent is to teach them that they can make that choice. Sometimes the choice is going to be easy. Sometimes it's going to be difficult, but they are always given to make that choice. However, back to happiness really quickly and away from parenting. I have recently, I've been studying the Bible and devotionals and stuff like that, but I've also been studying a few other things here and there. And I recently became aware, so we're talking about happiness. I became aware of an essay by the French philosopher Camus called The Myth of Sisyphus. Are you aware of this essay?
I think I've heard of it, but I don't know it.
So I'm going to butcher it slightly, but so two things. I'm going to start one thing that's slightly off topic. He very provocatively says early on in the essay that there is one philosophical question, and that question is whether to commit suicide or not to commit suicide. And he says that is the one philosophical question, because you have in your hands the power to end or not end your own life at any given time. So that is the only question of import. I find that both provocative and interesting. But the main thrust of the essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, is, and I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but Sisyphus was a Greek gentleman, I believe, who had an excess of hubris and challenged the gods. And so he was punished by having to roll a boulder up to the very top of a mountain. So he only had to do it theoretically once, except he starts rolling the boulder every morning, and every night the boulder rolls back down, the task uncompleted. Magic! So for eternity, he is toiling to roll that boulder up for it to always roll back down. So there's no point to his task but suffering. But what Camus says is Sisyphus can choose to be happy or unhappy in his task of eternal suffering. The gods can force him to suffer, but he can choose whether to be happy in his suffering or miserable in his suffering. And Camus ends the essay by saying, Camus imagines Sisyphus as happy in his suffering. And if that is correct, of course, this is a myth in any case, then I would contend that Sisyphus has actually defeated the gods, because the gods were trying to punish him. But if he is happy in his punishment, he's won. Anyways, something that I think about with happiness. And Camus was trying to draw a direct line between Sisyphus's suffering and the human condition. So, anyways.
Yeah.
E-commerce.
E-commerce. Next level. Awesome. No, this is great, man. So much fun. I think that's a good place to wrap up. You know, I love getting to know people. This is one of the reasons I do this. There's just so many really fascinating people out there doing cool things. Much more interesting to me than the things that people are doing is why they're doing it and how that's evolved over time. And so, you know, going deep like we have today is you know, it sounds like maybe it's not on topic, but to me it's really the core, like you were saying earlier, the core. So thank you so much for joining me. If people, we haven't talked too much about Fringe Sport. You have a gym.
We do.
Yeah.
We have the only free gym in Texas. Literally
as in
run it 100% free.
Wow.
Come by our gym in Austin, Texas. If you're visiting, if you live here, whatever, come by, get a workout in. It's open 9 to 6 Monday through Friday, 10 to 4 Saturday and Sunday. It is a fully outfitted 3,000 square foot gym and fitness facility that is free for everyone.
Now, how do you manage that? How free? What? What is this?
All right.
This is craziness.
So there's an old joke. So I went to the University of Texas. Our hated rivals were the Texas Aggies. So there's an old Aggie joke. And the Aggie joke is that there are a bunch of Aggies selling watermelons by the side of the road. After a while, one of the Aggies says to the other Aggie, "Hey, how much we buy these watermelons for?" Aggie says, $5. "How much are we selling them for?" $4. And so the first Aggie says, "You know, I can't get it. How are we going to make any money losing $1 a watermelon?" And the second Aggie says, "We'll make it up in volume."
Yeah.
So that's what I tell people when they say, how do you do that? But the real answer is, we are a direct consumer brand. We genuinely and truly believe in helping people improve lives through strength. And we do that, like I said, by helping people build amazing garage gyms and helping entrepreneurs build thriving community gyms. We have a retail store here in Austin, Texas that is right next to the gym. We needed a place to show our barbells, squat racks, stuff like that, a showroom, anyways. And so since we're going to be displaying this stuff, we're taking up most of the floor space that a gym would take anyways. And so early on, I decided to, as a gift to Austin and to our customers, to open a free gym. And everybody told me that it wouldn't make sense, it wouldn't work, there's this problem, that problem, whatever. And I said, at the point where it becomes a problem, we can stop having a free gym. And that was about 5 years ago, maybe six. It was 6 years ago. It's never been a problem. It's always been amazing. Our retail store does more business because of the free gym, so that helps support it. We get to see the community. People get to make improvements in their strength. I'm so happy that we're able to do that. And online, we provide a ton of content for how people can build awesome garage gyms and how entrepreneurs, like CrossFit gym owners and that sort of thing, can build thriving community gyms. And I view our free gym as essentially content marketing for our retail store. So I know we're closing up, but I do want to mention.
That's amazing. I got to say, that is amazing. Wow.
And it works. But I do want to end with one plug. And this is not a plug for Fringe Sport. Although if you need a barbell, blah, 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 whatever, that is a plug for Fringe Sport. Go to Fringe Sport. But my plug actually is, I'd mentioned before a couple of times, that we exist to help people improve lives through strength. I want to mention that the scientific studies show, and the black box as well, that stronger people live longer, happier, healthier lives. So all else equal, stronger people live longer, happier, healthier lives. So that's the scientific study and the black box thing. The second part of that is, it is easier to get stronger than you think it is.
Mm.
And so one of the things I like to end my emails with is, go lift something heavy today. It's something that I think almost anyone can benefit from. There's a dopamine hit to picking up something heavy and putting it down. So rather than say, go to Fringe Sport to buy your barbells, if you were inspired in any way by this podcast, go lift something heavy and smile while you're doing it.
Awesome. So
that's my plug.
Awesome. I want to talk more about this. This is an area that I want to improve, but we can maybe do that another
I can come back another. I mean, we can just talk as friends. That's cool too. But also, I'm more than happy to come back on and talk about some of the science behind people living longer, happier, healthier lives, or how you can get strength easier than you think you can.
I would love that. Awesome. So if people want to reach out to you, find out what you're up to, where would you suggest they go?
I would say you can always check out fringesport.com. You can find Fringe on Facebook or Instagram. If you want to find me, man, I am a ghosty MF-er. I've got three brothers, a stepbrother and a stepsister, and I've ghosted each one of them at some point in the recent past. That said, because I'm not super active on Instagram, I'm not super active on Twitter, I'm probably best on my email, just peter@fringesport.com.
Okay.
So if I've inspired you in some way, reach out to me, peter@fringesport.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day. I really appreciate you being here with me, and I think this has been a lot of fun. So thanks so much.
It's been awesome for me. Thanks, Isaac. It's been my pleasure. Go lift something heavy today.
Big, big thanks to Peter for sharing his story and for sharing how he thinks about business and life. And I love these kinds of talks again because how you think about things influences your actions. And I hope you picked up on a few of the actions that Peter was talking about. If you read the between the lines, you can tell he's very active in entrepreneurial groups. He's a president of the Toastmasters Club. He's a member of the Dynamite Circle, which I'm also a member of, which is where I got in touch with him originally. He's also in these other entrepreneurial communities. That's something we didn't talk about very much, but you can see how his thoughts and the way he thinks determines his actions. And of course, your actions are what give you results. So if you learned something from Peter today, something about the operating system for your life and your business, don't keep that to yourself. Share Peter's story and his message with a friend. pull out your phone and hit that share button. So I did want to mention what I was talking about at the top of the show one more time. The Survive and Thrive Summit that I just finished hosting was the very first step in building this community. It was actually a jump start. I hadn't planned on doing it so soon, but of course, there was a need, and so we went ahead and did it. So if you want to be involved, if you want to learn from all these people that we're pulling in, if you want to improve your life and learn how to survive and thrive through this crazy time, join us in the Facebook group. We're going to be putting out tons and tons of content, and there's a whole community there that you can be a part of. So if that sounds great, just head on over to surviveandthrivesummit.co, and that'll get you where you need to go. Dear listener, if you thought that was good, there is so much more coming. And now we've got a whole community to draw amazing stories from. Here's a sneak peek at what's coming next week.
Next time on Next Level E-Commerce.
At some point, I thought to myself, the people being interviewed in these podcasts don't seem much different from who I was. I thought to myself, you know, hey, maybe I could actually do this thing. So that was a really scary period for about 2 years where I was all in and lost a bunch of money. I was crying. I felt small. I had really low self-esteem. I thought, yeah, all my friends, they were doing really well in finance, accounting. Everybody's career was kind of going and making good money. We started it because we knew we were in it for the long haul, right? To compete as a proper brand. But if I wanted to, do a product opportunity, I would never go into the sleep mask space. It's just too darn competitive unless we bring something new, novel into the game. I did enjoy telling my parents, see, I told you.
You're mid 7 figures. You're aiming for 8. What do you think is going to take to get you there?
Thank you for listening to Next Level E-Commerce. Be sure to subscribe so you won't miss out on the next story.